bristling. We were an odd company, no doubt about it. I also noticed the rest of us didn't get a vote. This all rested on the question of how proud Eric was. In the silence, I wondered how long Eric would ponder his decision. If he didn't cave, we'd all die. That would be Victor's way of taking care of us, despite Eric's out loud thought about me being too valuable to kill. I didn't think Victor gave a fig for my value, much less Amelia's. Even if we overwhelmed Victor, and between Bill and Eric that could probably be managed, the rest of the vampires outside had only to set this house on fire, as they were threatening to do Fantasia, and we'd be gone. They might not be able to come in without an invitation, but we certainly had to get out. My eyes met Amelia's. Her brain was pinging with fear, though she was making a supreme effort to keep her spine stiff. If she called Copley, he would bargain for her life, and he had the wherewithal to bargain effectively. If the Las Vegas crew was hungry enough to invade Louisiana, then they were hungry enough to accept a bribe for the life of the daughter of Copley Carmichael. And surely Franny would be okay, since her brother was right outside. Surely they would spare Franny to keep Quinn complacent. Victor had already pointed out that Bill had skills they needed, because his computer database had proved lucrative. So Eric and I were the most expendable. I thought about Sam, wished I could call him and talk to him for just a minute. But I wouldn't drag him into this for the world, because that would mean his sure death. I closed my eyes and said goodbye to him. There was a sound outside the door, and it took me a moment to interpret it as a tiger's noise. Quinn wanted in. Eric looked at me, and I shook my head. This was bad enough without throwing Quinn into the mix. Amelia whispered, "Sookie," and pressed her hand against me. It was the hand with the knife. "Don't," I said. "It won't do any good." I hoped Victor didn't realize what her intent was. Eric's eyes were wide and fixed on the future. They blazed blue in the long silence. Then something unexpected happened. Franny snapped out of the trance, and she opened her mouth and began to scream. When the first shriek ripped out of her mouth, the door began to thud. In about 5 seconds, Quinn splintered my door by throwing his 450 pounds against it. Franny scrambled to her feet and ran for it, seizing the knob and yanking it open before Victor could grab her, though he missed her by a half an inch. Quinn bounded into the house so quickly he knocked his sister down. He stood over her, roaring at all of us. To his credit, Victor showed no fear. He said, "Quinn, listen to me." After a second, Quinn shut up. It was always hard to say how much humanity was left in the animal form of a shifter. I'd had evidence the Wares understood me perfectly, and I communicated with Quinn before when he was a tiger. He definitely comprehended. But hearing Franny scream had uncorked his rage, and he didn't seem to know where to aim it. While Victor was paying attention to Quinn, I fished a card out of my pocket. I hated the thought of using my great-grandfather's get-out-of-jail-free card so soon. "Love you, Gramps. Rescue me!" And I hated the thought of bringing him without warning into a room full of vampires. But if ever there was a time for fairy intervention, that time would be now, and I might have left it too late. I had my cell phone in my pajama pocket. I pulled it out surreptitiously and flipped it open, wishing I'd put him on speed dial. I looked down, checking the number, and began to press the buttons. Victor was talking to Quinn, trying to persuade him that Franny was not being hurt. Did I not do everything right? Did I not wait until I was sure I needed him before I called? Had I not been so clever to have the card on me, to have the phone with me? Sometimes, when you do everything right, it still turns out all wrong. Just as the call went through, a quick hand reached around, plucked the phone from my hand, and dashed it against the wall. "We can't bring him in," Eric said in my ear, "or a war will start that will kill all of us." I think he meant all of him, because I was pretty sure I would be okay if Great-Grandpa started a war to keep me that way, but there was no help for it now. I looked at Eric with something very close to hatred.
"There's no one you can call who would help you in this situation," Victor Madden said complacently, but
but then he looked a little less pleased with himself, as if he was having second thoughts.
"Unless there is something I don't know about you," he added.
"There is much you don't know about Sookie," Bill said. It was the first time he'd spoken since Madden had entered.
"Know this, I will die for her. If you harm her, I'll kill you."
Bill turned his dark eyes on Eric.
"Can you say the same?"
Eric plainly wouldn't, which put him behind in the who loves Sookie more stakes. At the moment, that wasn't so relevant.
"You must also know this," Eric said to Victor. "Even more pertinently, if anything happens to her, forces you can't imagine will be set into motion."
Victor looked deeply thoughtful.
"Of course, that could be an idle threat," he said. "But somehow, I believe you are serious. If you're referring to this tiger, though, I don't think he'll kill us all for her, since we have his mother and his sister in our grasp. The tiger has a lot to answer for, since I see his sister here."
Amelia had moved over to put her arm around Franny, both to soothe her and to include herself in the tiger's circle of protection. She looked at me, thinking very clearly. "Should I try some magic? Maybe a stasis spell?" It was very clever of Amelia to think of communicating this way with me, and I thought about her offer furiously. The stasis spell would hold everything exactly as it was, but I didn't know if her spell could encompass the vampires waiting outside, and I couldn't see the situation would be much improved if she froze only all of us in the room except for herself. Could she be specific about whom the spell affected? I wished that Amelia were telepathic too, and I'd never wished that on anyone before. As things lay, there was just too much I didn't know. Reluctantly, I shook my head.
"This is ridiculous," Victor said. His impatience was calculated. "Eric, this is the bottom line and my last offer. Do you accept my king's takeover of Louisiana and Arkansas, or do you want to fight to the death?"
There was another, shorter pause.
"I accept the sovereignty of your king,"
Eric said, his voice flat.
"Bill Compton?"
Victor asked. Bill looked at me, his dark eyes dwelling on my face.
"I accept,"
he said. And just like that, Louisiana had a new king, and the old regime was gone. Chapter 13. I felt the tension whoosh out of me like the air out of a punctured tire. Eric said,
"Victor, call your people off. I want to hear you tell them."
Victor, beaming harder than ever, whipped a tiny cell phone from his pocket and called someone named Delilah to give her his orders. Eric used his own cell to phone Fantasia. Eric told Clancy about the change in leadership.
"Don't forget to tell Pam," Eric said very clearly, "lest she kill off a few more of Victor's people."
There was an awkward pause. Everyone was wondering what came next. Now that I was pretty sure I was going to live, I hoped Quinn would change back to his human form so I could talk to him. There was a lot to talk about. I wasn't sure I had a right to feel this, but I felt betrayed. I don't think the world is about me. I could see he'd been forced into this situation. There was always a lot of forcing around vampires. As I saw it, this was the second time his mother had set Quinn up, quite inadvertently, to take her fall with the vamps. I got that she wasn't responsible. Truly, I did. She'd never wanted to be raped, and she hadn't chosen to become mentally ill. I'd never met the woman, and probably never would, but she was surely a loose cannon. Quinn had done what he could. He'd sent his sister ahead to warn us, though I wasn't exactly sure that had ended up helping so very much. But points for trying. Now, as I watched the tiger nuzzle Franny, I knew I'd made mistakes all the way down the line with Quinn, and I felt the anger of betrayal. No matter how I reasoned with myself, the image of seeing my boyfriend on the side of vampires I had to regard as enemies had lit a fire in me.
I shook myself, looking around the room.
Amelia had made a dash for the bathroom as soon as she could decently let go of Franny, who was still crying. I suspected the tension had been too much for my witchy roommate, and sounds from the hall bathroom confirmed that.
Eric was still on the phone with Clancy, pretending to be busy while he absorbed the huge change in his circumstances. I couldn't read his mind, but I knew that. He walked down the hall, maybe wanting some privacy to reassess his future.
Victor had gone outside to talk to his cohorts, and I heard one of them say, "Yeah, yes," as if his team had scored a winning goal, which I suppose was the case. As for me, I felt a little weak in the knees, and my thoughts were in such a tumult they could scarcely be called thoughts. Bill's arm went around me, and he lowered me to the chair Eric had vacated. I felt his cool lips brush my cheek. I would have to possess a heart of stone not to be affected by his little speech to Victor. I hadn't forgotten it, no matter how terrifying the night had been, and my heart is not made of stone. Bill knelt by my feet, his white face turned up to me.
"I hope someday you'll turn to me," he said. "I'll never force myself or my company on you."
And he got up and walked outside to meet his new vampire kin. Okie dokie. God bless me, the night wasn't over yet. I trudged back to my bedroom and pushed the door open, intending to wash my face or brush my teeth or make some stab at smoothing my hair, because I thought it might make me feel a little less trampled. Eric was sitting on my bed, his face buried in his hands. He looked up at me as I entered, and he looked shocked. Well, no wonder, what with the very thorough takeover and traumatic changing of the guard.
"Sitting here on your bed, smelling your scent," he said in a voice so low I had to strain to hear it. "Sookie, I remember everything."
"Oh, hell," I said, and went in the bathroom and shut the door. I brushed my hair and my teeth and scrubbed my face, but I had to come out. I was being as cowardly as Quinn if I didn't face the vampire. Eric started talking the minute I emerged.
"I can't believe I..."
Yeah, I know. Loved a mere human, made all those promises, was as sweet as pie, and wanted to stay with me forever," I muttered. Surely there was a shortcut we could take through this scene.
"I can't believe I felt something so strongly and was so happy for the first time in hundreds of years," Eric said with some dignity. "Give me some credit for that, too."
I rubbed my forehead. It was the middle of the night. I thought I was going to die. The man I'd been thinking of as my boyfriend had just turned my whole picture of him upside down. Though now his vamps were on the same side as my vamps, I had emotionally aligned myself with the vampires of Louisiana, even if some of them had been terrifying in the extreme. Could Victor Madden and his crew be any less scary? I thought not. This very night they'd killed quite a few vamps I'd known and liked. Coming on top of all these events, I didn't think I could cope with an Eric who just had a revelation.
"Can we talk about this some other time, if we have to talk about it?" I asked.
"Yes," he said after a long pause. "Yes, this isn't the right moment."
"I don't know that any time will be right for this conversation."
"But we're going to have it," Eric said.
"Eric, oh, okay." I made an erase movement with my hand. "I'm glad the new regime wants to keep you on."
"It would hurt you if I died."
"Yeah, we're bloodbound, yada, yada, yada."
"Not because of the bond."
"Okay, you're right. It would hurt me if you died. Also, I would have died too, most likely, so it wouldn't have hurt for long. Now, can you please scoot?"
"Oh, yes,"
he said with a return of the old Eric flair.
"I'll scoot for now, but I'm going to see you later. And rest assured, my lover, we'll come to an understanding. As for the vampires of Las Vegas, they'll be well suited to running another state that relies heavily on tourism. The King of Nevada is a powerful man, and Victor is not one you can take lightly. Victor is ruthless, but he won't destroy something he may be able to use. He's very good at reining in his temper.
So, you're not really that unhappy with the takeover? I couldn't keep the shock out of my voice.
It's happened,
Eric said.
There's no goal to be met in being unhappy now. I can't bring anyone back to life, and I can't defeat Nevada by myself. I won't ask my people to die in a futile attempt.
I just couldn't match Eric's pragmatism. I could see his points, and in fact, when I'd had some rest, I might agree with him. But not here. Not now. He seemed way too cold for me. Of course, he'd had a few hundred years to get that way, and maybe he'd had to go through this process many times. What a bleak prospect. Eric paused on his way out the door to bend down to kiss me on the cheek. This was another evening for collecting kisses.
I'm sorry about the tiger,
he said, and that was the final cap to the night as far as I was concerned. I sat slumped in the little chair in the bedroom corner until I was sure everyone was out of the house. When only one warm brain remained, Amelia's, I peered out of my room to get a visual. Yep, everyone else was gone. Amelia? I called.
Yeah?
She answered, and I went to find her. She was in the living room, and she was as exhausted as I was. Are you going to be able to sleep? I asked.
I don't know. I'm going to try. She shook her head. This changes everything.
Which this? Amazingly, she understood me. Oh, the vampire takeover. My dad had lots of dealings with the New Orleans vampires. He was going to be working for Sophie Ann, repairing her headquarters in New Orleans. All her other properties, too. I better call him and tell him. He's going to want to get in there early with the new guy. In her own way, Amelia was being as practical as Eric. I felt out of tune with the whole world. I couldn't think of anyone I could call who would feel the least bit mournful over the loss of Sophie Ann, Arla Yvonne, Cleo, and the list went on. It made me wonder, for the first time, if vampires might not get inured to loss. Look at all the life that passed them by and then vanished. Generation after generation went to their graves, while still the undead lived on and on. Well, this tired human, who would eventually pass on, needed some sleep in the worst possible way. If there was another hostile takeover tonight, it would have to proceed without me. I locked the doors all over again, called up the stairs to Amelia to tell her goodnight, and crawled back into my bed. I lay awake for at least 30 minutes, because my muscles twitched just when I was about to drift off. I would start up into full wakefulness, thinking someone was coming in the room to warn me about a great disaster. But finally, even the twitching couldn't keep me awake any longer. I fell into a heavy sleep. When I woke, the sun was up and shining in the window, and Quinn was sitting in the chair in the corner where I'd slumped the night before while I was trying to deal with Eric. This was an unpleasant trend. I didn't want a lot of guys popping in and out of my bedroom. I wanted one who would stay.
Who let you in?
I asked, propping myself up on one elbow. He looked good for someone who hadn't gotten much sleep. He was a very large man with a very smooth head and huge purple eyes. I had always loved the way he looked.
Amelia,
he said.
I know I shouldn't have come in. I should have waited until you were up. You might not want me in the house.
I went in the bathroom to give myself a minute, another ploy that was getting all too familiar. When I came out, a little neater and more awake than when I'd entered, Quinn had a mug of coffee for me. I took a sip and instantly felt better able to cope with whatever was coming, but not in my bedroom. Kitchen, I said, and we went to the room that had always been the heart of the house. It had been dated when the fire had gotten it. Now I had a brand new kitchen, but I still missed the old one. The table where my family had eaten for years had been replaced with a modern one, and the new chairs were lots more comfortable than the old ones, but regret still caught at me every now and then when I thought of what had been lost.
I had an ominous feeling that regret was going to be the theme of the day. During my troubled sleep, apparently I'd absorbed a dose of the practicality that had seemed so sad to me the night before. To stave off the conversation we were going to have, I stepped to the back door and looked to see that Amelia's car was gone. At least we were alone. I sat down opposite the man I'd hoped to love.
"Babe, you look like someone just told you I was dead,"
Quinn said. "Might as well have," I said, because I had to plow into this and look to neither the right nor the left. He flinched.
"Sookie, what could I have done?"
he asked.
"What could I have done?"
There was an edge of anger in his voice. "What can I do?" I asked in return, because I had no answer for him.
"I sent Franny. I tried to warn you."
"Too little too late," I said. I second-guessed myself immediately. Was I being too hard, unfair, ungrateful? "If you'd called me weeks ago, even once, I might feel different, but I guess you were too busy trying to find your mother."
"So you're breaking up with me because of my mother," he said.
He sounded bitter, and I didn't blame him. "Yes," I said after a moment's inner testing of my own resolve. "I think I am. It's not your mom as much as her whole situation. Your mother will always have to come first as long as she's alive, because she's so damaged. I've got sympathy for that, believe me, and I'm sorry that you and Franny have a hard row to hoe. I know all about hard rows." Quinn was looking down into his coffee mug, his face drawn with anger and weariness. This was probably the worst possible moment to be having this showdown, and yet it had to be done. I hurt too bad to let it last any longer.
"Yet, knowing all this, and knowing I care for you, you don't want to see me anymore,"
Quinn said, biting each word out.
"You don't want to try to make it work."
"I care for you, too, and I had hoped we'd have a lot more," I said. "But last night was just too much for me. Remember, I had to find out your past from someone else. I think maybe you didn't tell me about it from the start, because you knew it would be an issue. Not your pit fighting, I don't care about that, but your mom and Franny. Well, they're your family. They're dependent. They have to have you. They'll always come first." I stopped for a moment, biting the inside of my cheek. This was the hardest part. "I want to be first. I know that's selfish and maybe unattainable and maybe shallow, but I just want to come first with someone. If that's wrong of me, so be it. I'll be wrong, but that's the way I feel."
"Then there's nothing left to talk about,"
Quinn said after a moment's thought. He looked at me bleakly. I couldn't disagree. His big hands flat on the table, he pushed to his feet and left. I felt like a bad person. I felt miserable and bereft. I felt like a selfish bitch. But I let him walk out the door. Chapter 14. While I was getting ready for work, yes, even after a night like the one I'd had, I had to go to work, there was a knock at the front door. I'd heard something big coming down the driveway, so I tied my shoes hastily. The FedEx truck was not a frequent visitor at my house, and the thin woman who hopped out was a stranger. I opened the battered front door with some difficulty. It was never going to be the same after Quinn's entrance the night before. I made a mental note to call the Lowe's in Clarice to ask about a replacement. Maybe Jason would help me hang it. The FedEx lady gave a long look at the door's splintered condition when I finally got it open. "You want a sign for this?" she said as she held out a package, tactfully not commenting. "Sure." I accepted the box, a little puzzled. It had come from Fantasia. Huh. As soon as the truck had wheeled back out to Hummingbird Road, I opened the package. It was a red cell phone.
It was programmed to my number. There was a note with it. "Sorry about the other one, lover," it read, signed with a big E. There was a charger included, and a car charger, too, and a notice that my first 6 months' bill had been paid. With a kind of bemused feeling, I heard another truck coming. I didn't even bother to move from the front porch. The new arrival was from the Shreveport Home Depot. It was a new front door, very pretty, with a two-man crew to install it. All charges had been taken care of. I wondered if Eric would clean out my dryer vent. I got to Merlot's early so I could have a talk with Sam, but his office door was shut, and I could hear voices inside. Though not unheard of, the closed door was rare. I was instantly concerned and curious. I could read Sam's familiar mental signature, and there was another one that I had encountered before. I heard a scrape of chair legs inside, and I hastily stepped into the storeroom before the door opened. Tanya Grissom walked by. I waited for a couple of beats, then decided my business was so urgent I had to risk a conversation with Sam, though he might not be in the mood for it. My boss was still in his creaky wooden rolling chair, his feet propped on the desk. His hair was even more of a mess than usual. He looked like he had a reddish halo. He also looked thoughtful and preoccupied, but when I said I needed to tell him some things, he nodded and asked me to shut the door. "Do you know what happened last night?" I asked.
"I hear there was a hostile takeover," Sam said.
He tilted back on the springs of his rolling chair, and they squeaked in an irritating way. I was definitely balancing on a thin edge today, so I had to bite my lip to keep from snapping at him.
"Yeah, you might say that."
A hostile takeover was pretty much a perfect way to put it. I told him what had happened at my house. Sam looked troubled.
"I don't ever interfere in vamp business," he said. "The two-natured and vamps don't mix well. I'm really sorry you got pulled into that, Sookie. That asshole, Eric."
He looked like there was more he wanted to say, but he pressed his lips together. "Do you know anything about the King of Nevada?" I asked.
"I know he has a publishing empire," Sam said promptly. "And he has at least one casino and some restaurants. He's also the ultimate owner of a management company that handles vampire entertainers. You know, the Elvis Undead Review, with all vamp Elvis tribute artists, which is pretty funny when you think about it, and some great dance groups."
We both knew that the real Elvis was still around, but rarely in any shape to perform.
"If there had to be a takeover of a tourist state, Felipe de Castro is the right vampire for the job. He'll make sure New Orleans gets rebuilt like it ought to be, because he'll want the revenue."
"Felipe de Castro? That sounds exotic," I said.
"I haven't met him, but I understand he's very, charismatic," Sam said. "I wonder if he'll be coming to Louisiana to live, or if this Victor Madden will be his agent here. Either way, it won't affect the bar, but there's no doubt it'll affect you, Sookie."
Sam uncrossed his legs and sat up straight in his chair, which shrieked in protest.
"I wish there was some way to get you out of the vampire loop."
The night I met Bill, if I'd known what I know now, I wonder if I'd have done anything different, I said. Maybe I would have let the rat trays have him. I'd rescued Bill from a sleazy couple who turned out to be not only sleazy, but murderers. They were vampire drainers, people who lured vampires to spots where the vamps could be subdued with silver chains and drained of blood, which sold for big bucks on the black market. Drainers lived hazardous lives. The Rattrays had paid the full price.
"You don't mean that," Sam said.
He rocked in the chair again, squeak, squeak, and rose to his feet.
"You would never do that."
It felt really pleasant to hear something nice about myself, especially after the morning's conversation with Quinn. I was tempted to talk to Sam about that, too, but he was edging toward the door. Time to go to work for both of us. I got up too. We went out and began the usual motions. My mind was hardly on it, though. To revive my flagging spirits, I tried to think of some bright point in the future, something to look forward to. I couldn't come up with anything. For a long, bleak moment, I stood by the bar, my hand on my order pad, trying not to step over the edge into the chasm of depression. Then I slapped myself on the cheek. Idiot, I have a house and friends and a job. I'm luckier than millions of people on the planet. Things will look up. For a while, that worked. I smiled at everyone, and if that smile was brittle, by God, it was still a smile. After an hour or two, Jason came into the bar with his wife, Crystal. Crystal was looking sullen and slightly pregnant, and Jason was looking, well, he had that hard look about him, the mean look he got sometimes when he'd been disappointed. What's up? I asked.
Oh, not much, Jason said expansively. You bring us a couple beers?
Sure, I said, thinking he'd never ordered for Crystal before. Crystal was a pretty woman several years younger than Jason. She was a werepanther, but she wasn't a very good one, mostly because of all the inbreeding in the hotshot community. Crystal had a hard time changing if it wasn't the full moon, and she had miscarried at least twice that I knew of. I pitied her losses, the more so because I knew the panther community considered her weak. Now, Crystal was pregnant a third time. That pregnancy had maybe been the only reason Calvin had let her marry Jason, who was bitten, not born. That is, he'd become a panther by being repeatedly bitten by a jealous male who wanted Crystal for himself. Jason couldn't change into a real panther, but into a sort of half-beast, half-man version. He enjoyed it. I brought them their beers along with two frosted mugs and waited to see if they were going to place a food order. I wondered about Crystal drinking, but decided it wasn't my business.
I'd like me a cheeseburger with fries, Jason said. No surprise there.
What about you, Crystal? I asked, trying to sound friendly. After all, this was my sister-in-law. Oh, I don't have enough money to eat, she said.
I had no idea what to say. I looked at Jason inquiringly, and he gave me a shrug. This shrug said to his sister, I've done something stupid and wrong, but I'm not going to back down because I'm a stubborn shit.
Crystal, I'll be glad to stand you lunch, I said very quietly. What would you like?
She glared at her husband.
I'd like the same, Sookie.
I wrote her order down on a separate slip and strode to the hatch to turn them in. I had been ready to get angry, and Jason had lit a match and thrown it on my temper. The whole story was clear in their heads, and as I came to understand what was going on, I was sick of both of them. Crystal and Jason had settled into Jason's house, but almost every day Crystal rode out to Hotshot, her comfort zone, where she didn't have to pretend anything. She was used to being surrounded by her kin, and she especially missed her sister and her sister's babies. Tanya Grissom was renting a room from Crystal's sister, the room Crystal had lived in until she married Jason. Crystal and Tanya had become instant buddies. Since Tanya's favorite occupation was shopping, Crystal had gone along for the ride several times. In fact, she'd spent all the money Jason had given her for household expenses. She'd done this two paychecks in a row, despite multiple scenes and promises. Now, Jason refused to give her any more money. He was doing all the grocery shopping and picking up any dry cleaning, paying every bill himself. He told Crystal if she wanted any money of her own, she had to get a job. The unskilled and pregnant Crystal had not succeeded in finding one, so she didn't have a dime. Jason was trying to make a point, but by humiliating his wife in public, he was making the wrong point entirely. What an idiot my brother could be. What I could do about this situation? Well, nothing. They had to work it out themselves. I was looking at two stunted people who'd never grown up, and I wasn't optimistic about their chances. With a deep twinge of unease, I remembered their unusual wedding vows. At least, they'd seemed odd to me, though I suppose they were the hotshot norm. As Jason's closest living relative, I'd had to promise to take the punishment if Jason misbehaved, just as her uncle Calvin had promised the same on Crystal's behalf. I'd been pretty damn rash to make that promise. When I carried their plates to their table, I saw that the two were in the jaw-clenching, looking anywhere but at each other stage of quarreling. I put the plates down carefully, got them a bottle of Heinz ketchup, and skedaddled. I'd interfered enough by buying Crystal lunch. There was a person involved in this I could approach, and I promised myself then and there that I would. All my anger and unhappiness focused on Tanya Grissom. I really wanted to do something awful to that woman. What the hell was she hanging around for, sniffing around Sam? What was her goal in drawing Crystal into this spending spiral? And I didn't think for a second it was by chance that Tanya's newest big buddy was my sister-in-law. Was Tanya trying to irritate me to death? It was like having a horsefly buzzing around and lighting occasionally, but never quite close enough to swat. While I went about my job on autopilot, I pondered what I could do to get her out of my orbit. For the first time in my life, I wondered if I could forcibly pin another person down to read her mind. It wouldn't be so easy, since Tanya was a were-animal, but I would find out what was driving her. And I had the conviction that information would save me a lot of heartache, a lot. While I plotted and schemed and fumed, Crystal and Jason silently ate their food, and Jason pointedly paid his own bill while I took care of Crystal's. They left, and I wondered what their evening would be like. I was glad I wasn't going to be a party to it. From behind the bar, Sam had observed all this, and he asked me in a low voice,
"What's up with those two?"
"They're having the newlywed blues," I said. "Severe adjustment problems." He looked troubled.
"Don't let them drag you into it,"
he said, and then looked like he regretted opening his mouth.
"Sorry, don't mean to give you unwanted advice," he said.
Something prickled at the corners of my eyes. Sam was giving me advice because he cared about me. In my overwrought state, that was cause for sentimental tears. "That's okay, boss," I said, trying to sound perky and carefree. I spun on my heel and went to patrol my tables. Sheriff Bud Dearborn was sitting in my section, which was unusual. Normally, he'd pick a seat somewhere else if he knew I was working. Bud had a basket of onion rings in front of him, liberally doused with ketchup, and he was reading a Shreveport paper. The lead story was Police Search for Six, and I stopped to ask Bud if I could have his paper when he was through with it. He looked at me suspiciously. His little eyes and his mashed-in face scanned me as if he suspected he'd find a bloody cleaver hanging from my belt.
"Sure, Sookie," he said after a long moment. "You got any of these missing people stowed away at your house?"
I beamed at him, anxiety transforming my smile into the bright grin of someone who wasn't all there mentally. "No, Bud, I just want to find out what's going on in the world. I'm behind on the news."
Bud said, "I'll leave it on the table,"
and he began reading again. I think he would have pinned Jimmy Hoffa on me if he could have figured a way to make it stick. Not that he necessarily thought I was a murderer, but he thought I was fishy and maybe involved in things that he didn't want happening in his parish. Bud Dearborn and Al C. Beck had that conviction in common, especially since the death of the man in the library. Luckily for me, the man had turned out to have a record as long as my arm, and not only a record, but one for violent crimes. Though Al C. knew I'd acted in self-defense, he'd never trust me, and neither would Bud Dearborn. When Bud had finished his beer and his onion rings and departed to rain terror on the evildoers of Renard Parish, I took his paper over to the bar and read the story with Sam looking over my shoulder. I had deliberately stayed away from the news after the bloodbath at the empty office park. I'd been sure the Ware community couldn't cover up something so big. All they could do was muddy the trail the police would surely be following. That proved to be the case. It read, "After more than 24 hours, police remain baffled in their search for six missing Shreveport citizens. Hampering them is their inability to discover anyone who saw any of the missing people after 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. We can't find anything they had in common," said Detective Willie Cromwell. Among the missing is a Shreveport police detective, Cal Myers, Amanda Watley, owner of a bar in the central Shreveport area, Patrick Fernan,
owner of the local Harley-Davidson dealership, and his wife, Libby, Christine Larrabee, widow of John Larrabee, retired school superintendent, and Julio Martinez, an airman from Barksdale Air Force Base. Neighbors of the Fernans say they hadn't seen Libby Fernan for a day prior to Patrick Fernan's disappearance, and Christine Larrabee's cousin says she had not been able to contact Larrabee by phone for 3 days. So police speculate that the two women may have met with foul play prior to the disappearance of the others. The disappearance of Detective Cal Myers has the force on edge. His partner, Detective Mike Laughlin, said, "Myers was one of the newly promoted detectives, and we hadn't had time to get to know each other well. I have no idea what could have happened to him." Myers, 29, had been with the Shreveport force for 7 years. He was not married. "If they are all dead, you would think at least one body would have turned up by now," Detective Cromwell said yesterday. "We have searched all the residences and businesses for clues, and so far we've come up with nothing." To add to the mystery, on Monday, another Shreveport area resident was murdered. Maria Starr Cooper, a photographer's assistant, was slain in her apartment on Highway 3. "The apartment was like a butcher shop," said Cooper's landlord, among the first on the scene. "No suspects have been reported in the slaying." "Everyone loved Maria Starr," said her mother, Anita Cooper. "She was so talented and pretty." Police do not know yet if Cooper's death is related to the disappearances. In other news, Don Dominica, owner of Don's RV Park, reported the absence of the owners of 3 RVs parked on his property for a week. "I'm not sure how many people were in each trailer," he said. "They all arrived together and rented the spaces for a month. The name on the rental is Priscilla A. Bear. I think at least 6 people were in each RV. They all seemed pretty normal to me." Asked if all their belongings were still in place, Dominica replied, "I don't know. I haven't been checking. I ain't got time for that, but I haven't seen hide nor hair of them for days." Other residents of the RV park had not met the newcomers. "They kept to themselves," said a neighbor. Police Chief Parfit Graham said, "I'm sure we'll solve these crimes. The right piece of information will surface. In the meantime, if anyone has knowledge of the whereabouts of any of these people, call the tipster hotline." I considered it. I imagined the phone call. "All of these people died as a result of the werewolf war," I would say. "They were all wares, and a displaced and hungry pack from South Louisiana decided the dissension in the ranks in Shreveport created an opening for them." I didn't think I'd get much of a hearing.
"So they haven't found the site yet," Sam said very quietly.
"I guess that really was a good place for the meeting."
"Sooner or later, though."
"Yeah. I wonder what's left."
Alcide's crew had plenty of time now, Sam said, "so not much. They probably burned the bodies somewhere out in the sticks, or buried them on someone's land."
I shuddered. Thank God I hadn't had to be part of that. And at least I really didn't know where the bodies were buried. After checking my tables and serving some more drinks, I went back to the paper and flipped it open to the obituaries. Reading down the column headed State Deaths, I got an awful shock.
Sophie Ann LeClaire, prominent businesswoman residing in Baton Rouge since Katrina, died of sino-AIDS in her home. LeClaire, a vampire, had extensive holdings in New Orleans and in many places in the state. Sources close to LeClaire say she had lived in Louisiana for 100 years or more.
I had never seen an obituary for a vampire. This one was a complete fabrication. Sophie Ann had not had sino-AIDS, the only disease that could cross from humans to vampires. Sophie Ann had probably had an acute attack of Mr. Steak. Sino-AIDS was dreaded among vampires, of course, despite the fact that it was hard to communicate. At least it provided a palatable explanation for the human business community as to why Sophie Ann's holdings were being managed by another vampire. And it was an explanation that no one would question too closely, especially since there was no body to refute the claim. To get it in today's paper, someone must have called it in directly after she'd been killed, perhaps even before she was dead. Ugh, I shivered. I wondered what had really happened to Siebert, Sophie Ann's devoted bodyguard. Victor had implied Siebert had perished along with the Queen, but he hadn't definitely said so. I couldn't believe the bodyguard could still be alive. He would never have let anyone get close enough to kill Sophie Ann. Siebert had been at her side for so many years, hundreds upon hundreds, that I didn't think he could have survived her loss. I left the newspaper open to the obituaries and placed it on Sam's desk, figuring the bar was too busy a place to talk about it, even if we had the time. We'd had an influx of customers. I was running my feet off, serving them and pocketing some good tips, too. But after the week I'd had, it was not only hard to feel normally happy about the money, it was also impossible to feel normally cheerful about being at work. I just did my best to smile and respond when I was spoken to. By the time I got off work, I didn't want to talk to anyone about anything. But of course, I didn't get my druthers. There were two women waiting in the front yard at my house, and they both radiated anger. One, I already knew, Franny Quinn. The woman with her had to be Quinn's mother. In the harsh glare of the security light, I had a good look at the woman whose life had been such a disaster. I realized no one had ever told me her name. She was still pretty, but in a goth sort of way that wasn't kind to her age. She was in her 40s, her face was gaunt, her eyes shadowed. She had dark hair with more than a touch of gray, and she was very tall and thin. Franny was wearing a tank top that showed her bra and tight jeans and boots. Her mother was wearing pretty much the same outfit, but in different colors. I guessed Franny had charge of dressing her mother. I parked beside them because I had no intention of inviting them in. I got out of my car reluctantly.
"You bitch!"
Franny said passionately. Her young face was rigid with anger.
"How could you do that to my brother? He did so much for you!"
That was one way to look at it. "Franny," I said, keeping my voice as calm and level as I could, "what happens between Quinn and me is really not any of your business." The front door opened, and Amelia stepped out on the porch. "Sookie, you need me?" she asked, and I smelled magic around her. "I'm coming in just a second," I said clearly, but I didn't tell her to go back inside. Mrs. Quinn was a pure-blood were-tiger, and Franny was half. They were both stronger than me. Mrs. Quinn stepped forward and looked at me quizzically.
"You're the one John loved," she said. "You're the one who broke up with him."
"Yes, ma'am. It just wasn't going to work out."
"They say I have to go back to that place in the desert," she said, "where they store all the crazy wares."
"No shit." "Oh, do they?" I said, to make it clear I had nothing to do with it.
"Yes,"
she said, and lapsed into silence, which was kind of a big relief. Franny, however, had not done with me.
"I loaned you my car," she said. "I came to warn you."
"And I thank you," I said. My heart sank. I couldn't think of any magic words to lessen the pain in the air. "Believe me, I wish things had worked out different." Lame, but true.
"What's wrong with my brother?" Franny asked. "He's handsome, he loves you, he's got money, he's a great guy. What's wrong with you that you don't want him?"
The bald answer, that I really admired Quinn, but didn't want to play second fiddle to his family's needs, was simply unspeakable for two reasons. It was unnecessarily hurtful, and I might be seriously injured as a result. Mrs. Quinn might not be compos mentis, but she was listening with growing agitation. If she changed to her tiger form, I had no idea what would happen. She might run off into the woods, or she might attack. All this zoomed through my mind in little pictures. I had to say something. "Franny," I said very slowly and deliberately, because I had no idea what I was going to follow that up with.
"There's nothing wrong with your brother at all. I think he's the greatest. But we just have too many strikes against us as a couple.
I want him to have the best chance at making a match with some lucky, lucky woman. So I cut him loose. Believe me, I'm hurting too.
This was mostly true, which helped. But I hoped Amelia had her fingertips primed to deliver some good magic. And I hoped she got the spell right. Just in case, I began shifting away from Franny and her mother. Franny was teetering on the brink of action, and her mother was looking increasingly restless. Amelia had eased forward to the edge of the porch. The smell of magic intensified. For a long moment, the night seemed to catch its breath. And then, Franny turned away.
"Come on, Mama,"
she said, and the two women got into Franny's car. I took advantage of the moment to run up on the porch. Amelia and I stood shoulder to shoulder, wordlessly, until Franny started up the car and drove away.
"Well," Amelia said, "so you broke up with him, I'm gathering?"
"Yeah, I was exhausted. He had too much baggage."
Then I winced.
Gosh, I never thought I'd catch myself saying that, especially considering my own.
He had his mama. Amelia was on a perceptive roll that night.
"Yeah, he had his mama. Listen, thanks for coming out of the house and risking a mauling."
"What are roommates for?"
Amelia gave me a light hug and said, "You look like you need to have a bowl of soup and go to bed."
"Yeah," I said, "that sounds about right."
Chapter 15. I slept very late the next day, and I slept like a stone. I didn't dream. I didn't toss or turn. I didn't get up to pee. When I woke up, it was close to noon, so it was good I didn't have to be at Merlot's until evening. I could hear voices in the living room. This was the downside of having a roommate. There was someone there when you woke up, and sometimes that person had company. However, Amelia was very good about making enough coffee for me when she got up earlier. That prospect got me out of bed. I had to get dressed since we had company. Besides, the other voice sounded masculine. I did a little brisk grooming in the bathroom and threw off my nightgown. I put on a bra and t-shirt and some khakis. Good enough. I made a beeline for the kitchen and found that Amelia had indeed made a big pot of coffee, and she'd left a mug ready for me. Oh, great. I poured and popped some sourdough bread in the toaster. The back porch door slammed, and I turned in surprise to see Tyrese Marley enter with an armful of firewood.
"Where do you keep your wood after you bring it in?"
he asked.
"I have a rack by the fireplace in the living room."
He'd been splitting the wood Jason had cut and stacked by the tool shed the spring before.
"That's really nice of you," I said, floundering. "Have you had any coffee or some toast? Or," I glanced at the clock, "what about a ham or meatloaf sandwich?"
"Food sounds good,"
he said, striding down the hall as though the wood weighed nothing. So the guest in the living room was Copley Carmichael. Why Amelia's dad was here, I had no clue. I scrambled to assemble a couple of sandwiches, poured some water, and put two kinds of chips by his plate so Marley could pick what he wanted. Then I sat down at the table myself and finally got to drink my coffee and eat my toast. I still had some of my grandmother's plum jam to spread on it, and I tried not to be melancholy every time I used it. No point in letting good jam go to waste. She would have certainly looked at it that way. Marley returned and sat down opposite me with no sign of discomfort. I relaxed myself. "I appreciate the work," I said after he'd had a bite of his food.
"I got nothing else to do while he talks to Amelia," Marley said. "Plus, if she's still here all winter, he'll be glad if she can have a fire. Who cut that wood for you and didn't split it?"
"My brother," I said.
"Hmph,"
Marley said, and settled into eating. I finished my toast, poured myself a second mug of coffee, and asked Marley if he needed anything.
"I'm good, thank you,"
he said, and opened the bag of barbecue potato chips. I excused myself to take a shower. It was definitely cooler today, and I got a long-sleeve t-shirt out of a drawer I hadn't opened in months. It was Halloween weather. It was past time to buy a pumpkin and some candy,
not that I got many trick-or-treaters. For the first time in days, I felt normal. That is to say, comfortably happy with myself and my world. There was a lot to grieve about, and I would, but I wasn't walking around expecting a smack in the face. Of course, the minute I thought that, I began to brood on bad things. I realized I hadn't heard anything from the Shreveport vampires, and then I wondered why I thought I should or would. This period of adjustment from one regime to another had to be full of tension and negotiation, and it was best to leave them to it. I hadn't heard from the Wares of Shreveport either. Since the investigation into the disappearance of all those people was still active, that was a good thing. And since I'd just broken up with my boyfriend, that meant, theoretically, I was footloose and fancy free. I put on eye makeup as a gesture toward my freedom, and then I added some lipstick. It was hard to feel adventurous, actually. I hadn't wanted to be fancy free. As I finished making my bed, Amelia knocked at my door. "Come on in," I said, folding my nightgown and putting it in the drawer. "What's up?"
"Well, my father has a favor to ask you," she said.
I could feel my face settle into grim lines. Of course, there had to be something Copley wanted if he'd driven up from New Orleans to talk to his daughter, and I could imagine what that request was.
"Go on," I said, crossing my arms over my chest.
"Oh, Sookie, your body language is already saying no."
"Ignore my body and speak your piece."
She heaved a big sigh to indicate how reluctant she was to drag me into her dad's stuff, but I could tell she was tickled pink that he'd asked her to help him.
"Well, since I told him about the Vegas vampire takeover, he wants to reestablish his business link with the vampires. He wants an introduction. He was hoping you could, like, broker that."
"I don't even know Felipe de Castro."
"No, but you know that Victor, and he looks like he's got his eyes on his own advancement."
"You know him as well as I do," I pointed out.
"Maybe, but what's more important is that he knows who you are, and I'm just the other woman in the room," Amelia said, and I could see her point, though I hated it.
"I mean, he knows who I am, who my dad is, but he really noticed you."
"Oh, Amelia," I moaned, and for just a moment felt like kicking her. "I know you won't like this, but he said he was ready to pay, like, a finder's fee," Amelia muttered, looking embarrassed.
I waved my hands in front of me to fan that thought away. I was not going to let my friend's father pay me money to make a phone call or whatever I had to do. At that moment, I knew I'd decided I had to do this for Amelia's sake. We went to the living room to talk face to face with Copley. He greeted me with far more enthusiasm than he'd shown on his previous visit. He fixed his gaze on me, did the whole "I'm focused on you" thing. I regarded him with a skeptical eye. Since he was no fool, he picked up on that immediately.
"I'm sorry, Miss Stackhouse, for intruding here so soon after my last visit," he said, laying on the smarm. "But things in New Orleans are so desperate. We're trying to rebuild to bring the jobs back in. This connection is really important to me, and I employ a lot of people."
One, I didn't think Copley Carmichael was hurting for business, even without the contracts for rebuilding the vampire properties. Two, I didn't for a minute think his sole motivation was the improvement of the damaged city. But after a moment of looking into his head, I was willing to concede that accounted for at least a fraction of his urgency. Also, Marley had split the wood for the winter and carried a load in. That counted for more with me than any appeal based on emotion. "I'll call Fantasia tonight," I said. "I'll see what they say. That's the limit of my involvement."
"Miss Stackhouse, I'm indeed indebted," he said. "What can I do for you?"
"Your chauffeur already did it," I said. "If he could finish splitting that oak, that would be a great favor." I'm not a very good wood splitter, and I know because I've tried. 3 or 4 logs done, and I'm wiped out.
"That's what he's been doing?"
Copley did a good job of looking astonished. I wasn't sure if it was genuine or not.
"Well, How enterprising of Marley.
Amelia was smiling and trying not to let her dad notice it. Okay, then we're settled, she said briskly. Dad, can I fix you a sandwich or soup? We have some chips or some potato salad.
Sounds good, he said, since he was still trying to be just plain folks.
Marley and I have already eaten, I said casually, and added, I need to run to town, Amelia. You need anything? I could use some stamps, she said. You going by the post office?
I shrugged.
It's on the way. Bye, Mr. Carmichael.
Call me Cope, please, Sookie.
I'd just known he was going to say that. Next, he was going to try being courtly. Sure enough, he smiled at me with exactly the right blend of admiration and respect. I got my purse and headed out the back door. Marley was still working on the woodpile in his shirt sleeves. I hoped that had been his very own idea. I hoped he got a raise. I didn't really have anything to do in town, but I had wanted to dodge any further conversation with Amelia's dad. I stopped by the store and got some more paper towels, bread, and tuna, and I stopped by the Sonic and got an Oreo Blast. Oh, I was a bad girl, no doubt about it. I was sitting in my car working on the Blast when I spied an interesting couple two cars away. They hadn't noticed me, apparently, because Tanya and Arlene were talking steadily. The two were in Tanya's Mustang. Arlene's hair was newly colored, so it was flaming red to the roots, caught up at the back in a banana clip. My former friend was wearing a tiger print knit top, all I could see of her ensemble. Tanya was wearing a pretty lime green blouse and a dark brown sweater, and she was listening intently. I tried to believe they were talking about something other than me. I mean, I try not to be too paranoid, but when you see your ex-buddy talking to your known enemy, you have to at least entertain the possibility that the topic of you has come up in an unflattering way. It wasn't so much that they didn't like me. I've known people all my life who didn't like me. I've known exactly why and how much they didn't like me. That's really unpleasant, as you can well imagine. What bothered me was that I thought Arlene and Tanya were moving into the realm of actually doing something to me. I wondered what I could find out. If I moved closer, they'd definitely notice me, but I wasn't sure I could hear them from where I was. I bent over like I was fiddling with my CD player, and I focused on them. I tried to mentally skip over or plow through the people in the intervening cars to reach them, which wasn't an easy task. Finally, the familiar pattern of Arlene helped me to home in. The first impression I got was one of pleasure. Arlene was enjoying herself immensely, since she had the undivided attention of a fairly new audience, and she was getting to talk about her new boyfriend's convictions about the need to kill all vampires and maybe people who collaborated with them. Arlene had no hard convictions that she'd formed for herself, but she was great at adopting other people's if they suited her emotionally. When Tanya had an especially strong surge of exasperation, I zoomed in on her thought pattern. I was in. I remained in my half-concealed position, my hand moving every now and then over the CDs in my little car folder, while I tried to pick out everything I could. Tanya was still in the pay of the Pelts, Sandra Pelt specifically, and gradually I came to understand that Tanya had been sent here to do anything she could to make me miserable. Sandra Pelt was the sister of Debbie Pelt, whom I'd shot to death in my kitchen, after she'd tried to kill me several times. Let me point that out. Damn it, I was sick to death of the issue of Debbie Pelt. The woman had been a bane to me alive. She had been as malicious and vindictive as her little sister Sandra. I'd suffered over her death, felt guilty, felt remorseful, felt like I had a huge C for Cain on my forehead. Killing a vampire is bad enough, but the corpse goes away, and they're sort of erased. Killing another human being changes you forever. That's how it ought to be. But it's possible to grow sick of that feeling, tired of that albatross around your emotional neck. And I'd grown both sick and tired of Debbie Pelt. Then her sister and her parents had begun giving me grief,
had had me kidnapped. The tables had turned, and I'd held them in my power. In return for me letting them go, they'd agreed to leave me alone. Sandra had promised to stay away until her parents died. I had to wonder if the elder pelts were still among the living. I started up my car and began cruising around Bonton, waving at familiar faces in almost every vehicle I passed. I had no idea what to do. I stopped at the little town park and got out of my car. I began to stroll, my hands jammed in my pockets. My head was all in a snarl. I remember the night I'd confessed to my first lover, Bill, that my great-uncle had molested me when I'd been a child. Bill had taken my story so to heart that he had arranged for a visitor to drop by my great-uncle's house. Lo and behold, my uncle had died from a fall down the stairs. I'd been furious at Bill for taking over my own past, but I couldn't deny that having my great-uncle dead had felt good. That profound relief had made me feel complicit in the assassination. When I'd been trying to find survivors in the twisted debris of the Pyramid of Giza, I had found someone still living, a vampire who wanted to keep me firmly under his control for the Queen's benefit. Andre had been terribly wounded, but he would have lived if an injured Quinn hadn't crawled over and snuffed Andre out. I'd walked away without stopping Quinn or saving Andre, and that had made me several degrees more guilty of Andre's death than of my great-uncle's. I strode through the empty park, kicking at the stray leaves that came my way. I was struggling with a sick temptation. I had only to say the word to any of many members of the supernatural community, and Tanya would be dead. Or I could set my sights on the source and have Sandra taken out. And again, what a relief her departure from the world would be. I just couldn't do it. But I couldn't live with Tanya nipping at my heels, either. She'd done her best to ruin my brother's already shaky relationship with his wife. That was just wrong. I finally thought of the right person to consult, and she lived with me, so that was convenient. When I got back to my house, Amelia's dad and his obliging chauffeur had departed. Amelia was in the kitchen, washing dishes. "Amelia?" I said, and she jumped. "Sorry," I said. "I should have walked heavier." "I was hoping that my dad and I understood each other a little better," she confessed. "But I don't think that's really true. He just needs me to do something for him now and then." "Well, at least we got the firewood split." She laughed a little and dried off her hands. "You look like you have something big to say." "I want to clear the decks before I tell you this long story. I'm doing your dad a favor, but I'm really doing it for you," I said. "I'll call Fantasia for your father no matter what, because you're my roommate and that'll make you happy. So that's a done deal. Now, I'm going to tell you about a terrible thing I did." Amelia sat at the table and I sat opposite her, just like Marley and I had done earlier.
"This sounds interesting," she said.
"I'm ready. Bring it on." I told Amelia all about it. Debbie Pelt, Alcide, Sandra Pelt and her parents, their vow that Sandra would never bother me again while they lived. What they had on me and how I felt about it. Tanya Grissom, spy and sneak and saboteur of my brother's marriage.
"Whoa," she said when I'd finished. She thought for a minute. "Okay, first off, let's check on Mr. and Mrs. Pelt."
We used the computer I'd brought back from Hadley's apartment in New Orleans. It took all of 5 minutes to discover that Gordon and Barbara Pelt had died 2 weeks before when they'd attempted to make a left turn into a gas station, only to be hit broadside by a tractor trailer. We looked at each other, our noses wrinkled.
"Ew," Amelia said. "Bad way to go."
"I wonder if she even waited till they were in the ground before she activated the aggravate Sookie to death plan," I said.
"This bitch isn't going to let up. You sure Debbie Pelt was adopted? Because this totally vindictive attitude seems to run in that family."
"They must have really bonded," I said. In fact, I got the impression that Debbie was more of a sister to Sandra than she was a daughter to her parents. Amelia nodded thoughtfully.
A little pathology going on there, she said. Well, let me think about what I can do. I don't do death magic, and you've said you don't want Tanya and Sandra to die, so I'm taking you at your word.
Good, I said briefly. And, I'm willing to pay for this, of course.
Pooh,
Amelia said. You were willing to take me in when I needed to get out of town. You've put up with me all this time.
Well, you do pay rent, I pointed out.
Yeah, enough to cover my part of the utilities. And you put up with me, and you don't seem to...